Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So how are we doing this morning? Pretty good?
Well,
I hope so. Hope everyone's doing great. So this morning I'm going to talk about a koan, a little story. And many of you are familiar with koans, have worked with them quite a lot, but some of you are not. So I'm just going to give a very brief introduction to what koans are. They're little stories. Most of them come from some pretty ancient Zen in China and Japan. And they challenge your way of thinking. That is the intention, one of the intentions. Most of us, when we encounter Zen, I think, when we first encounter it, we bring our ordinary learning approach to it. We think if we can just learn enough about it, if we can read all the books and listen to all the talks and understand the philosophy, we'll get what Zen is about. But it really doesn't work that way. And we really have to actually let go of that approach to penetrate Zen. Those things can help, but that's not the heart of it. What you want to make out of the world with your mind, what you think about the world, is not the only way to see the world. We miss a lot. Whatever you think the world is, that's not what it is. And it's the job of the Zen teacher to say, no, that's not it. And if you come back and say, oh, but I think it's this, it's the Zen teacher's job to come back again and say, no, that's not it either. And this can be maybe a little bit frustrating. It's sort of this endless negation. But it takes you to a place of openness, I think, a real place of openness. Well, if it's not that, and if it's not that, and if it's not that, what is it? And you're kind of there with the big question. You're just there with the question and the frustration. And that's a very fertile place to be. And it's not easy to describe this place of openness. It has something to do with being present with the immediacy of it and the mystery of it, without any kind of analysis whatsoever. So, ironically, we use words and language to talk about these koans, such as in my talk today, but that really can't be helped. We use words to point to something that's beyond words, something that's experiential. So this koan is from the Blue Cliff Record. It's case 35. It's called Manjushri's Threes and Threes, and it's on your program. If you picked one up, you can follow along if you wish. Some koans are kind of jarring, I think. This one, when I first read it, I thought, oh, I love this koan. It just, something struck me right away about this koan. And the more time I spent with it, the more I liked it. It just seems beautiful to me. So I'm using a translation by Katsuki Sakita from his book Two Zen Classics. And I relied on his commentary quite a lot, too. So I'll begin with reading it. Case 35. Here we go. First, there's an introduction, Engo's introduction. In distinguishing dragon from snake, jewel from stone, black from white, irresolute from decisive, if one does not have the clear eye of the mind and the amulet under the arm, one invites instant failure. Just at this moment, if one's vision and hearing are clear, and color and sound are truly cognized, tell me, is he black or white, crooked or straight? The subtle difference. How could you discern it? And then here's the main subject. Manjushri asked Muchaku, where have you recently come from? Muchaku said, from the south. How is southern Buddhism faring? Asked Manjushri. The monks of the latter days of the law observe the Buddha's precepts a little, Muchaku answered. Are there many or few? Here about 300, there around 500. Then Muchaku asked Manjushri, how does Buddhism fare in your part of the world? Manjushri said, the worldly and the holy are living together. Dragons and snakes are mingled. Are there many or few? The former threes and threes, the latter threes and threes. So what is this bit of nonsense anyway? I will offer one possible interpretation. And I'll start with the introduction. In distinguishing dragon from snake, jewel from stone, black from white, irresolute from decisive, if one does not have the clear eye of the mind and the amulet under the arm, one invites instant failure. So we distinguish things. We come up with language, concepts, ideas, analysis to distinguish one thing from another. We distinguish dragon from snake. That's how our minds work. Sakita says that distinguishing dragon from snake is distinguishing a promising dragon-like monk from a commonplace one. And he says irresolute from decisive is also about the quality of monks. And then we have black and white, jewel and stone. These could also be about the quality of monks, but really this could be about any time we distinguish one thing from another. These four things, I think, stand in for every kind of distinguishing that we ever do. So this is our usual way of approaching the world. This is our customary way of learning. And of course, this distinguishing, this making of distinctions is useful. I'm not dissing it completely. If you're training monks, you have to know the differences between them. If you're playing chess, you have to be able to tell black from white. But you can invite instant failure, the koan says. So what's this? What is this instant failure that we can invite? Apparently, we need to place this world of distinguishing things in some kind of perspective. We need some kind of skill or wisdom. We need the clear eye of the mind or the amulet under the arm, something kind of magical. We need something special here. So, just at this moment, if one's vision and hearing are clear and color and sound are truly cognized, tell me, is he black or white, crooked or straight? This, I think, is about Zen practice. This is about a way of being that calls these distinctions into question. And what is this way of being? As I said, it's hard to describe. But I'm going to use an example I've used before just because it's my favorite example. Imagine you're coming to Zen Center and you're arriving and you stop to look at the lake. And you may bring your sort of ordinary, your conventional mind to it, and you're thinking about it. And you say, this is a beautiful lake that makes me feel good. Or you might think, I'd like to take a picture of this lake. I'd like to have something from this lake to take with me. Or maybe you're simply giving it a name, lake. You're injecting some commentary in here. But then imagine you spend several hours at Zen Center and you've been sitting for hours and you've had an oryoki meal and you've engaged in mindful activity and you've heard a lecture or something. This talk maybe challenged everything you knew, and it kind of opened you up a bit, and you're in a different place. And you leave the Zendo, and you see the lake, and it just hits you. And those comments aren't there, because your mind is quiet enough that it's just lake. You're completely receptive, and you allow it to come to you. That's the difference. You're not reaching for the lake and trying to think, how can I describe this? How does this work in my world? No, it's just this lake. I'm going to let it be. And wow, there it is. And you see it, and you don't know what it is yet. You don't give it a name. This is before knowing. This is just being there. So this way of seeing is always there. We all have it, but it's obscured. And we don't see it because our mind is so persistent in kicking in and obscuring it. But we can uncover this before. We can uncover this through practice. So if you can see before you know, distinctions between things disappear. And it's clear that everything is interdependent and there are no absolutes. You could say that everything is relative. And we hear that a lot, that everything is kind of relative. We'll hear that in Zen. And that can be useful, but I want to stop here a moment and digress just a bit and talk about a common misunderstanding of Zen Buddhism. Because often we'll talk about how there are no distinctions, things are relative, we might even say that there is no good and evil. And there's some truth in that. There's some truth in that about things being just what they are, beyond our concepts of what they are. But sometimes this is taken to mean that we're not limited by concepts of good and bad, or that there's some kind of moral relativism, or we can do whatever we want, and nothing could be farther from the truth. When we talk about things being beyond distinctions, that's about seeing clearly. Seeing clearly leads to action, and action must be ethical. If I'm beyond distinctions, I see that I am you. There's no difference between us. And if you're smiling, I'm smiling. And if that's how it is, how could I treat you differently from me? We're interdependent, and ethics is absolutely important. My welfare and your welfare are just the same. So I'm absolutely committed to ethical behavior toward you, toward everyone else. And that is an essential part of our practice. So that was the little digression. And back to the koan, vision and hearing can be clear. And then the koan goes, the subtle difference, how could you discern it? So the difference between the world of distinctions, this world of knowing, and the world of before knowing is subtle. He's kind of introducing the story. Engo is kind of saying, perhaps it will help us, this story will help us to discern this subtle difference. And so now we get to the actual case, and we have two characters here. We have Manjushri, first of all. Manjushri is a mythical being. He is a bodhisattva. He's the bodhisattva of wisdom. He's devoted to helping all beings. And that is who is above me here on the altar, Manjushri. He's often shown with a sword cutting through delusion. He's the Zen teacher who says, no, it's not that. No, it's not that. And you go, oh, it's not that. No, it's not that either. Here he is shown sitting on a lion, and the lion looks rather fierce, or maybe it's a tiger, I'm not sure. And he is very quiet. He has great equanimity in a very kind of crazy and scary world, which is a nice way to be. So that's Manjushri. The other person is Muchaku. Muchaku was a real person who lived from 821 to 900 in China. And as a youth, he traveled all around the country visiting Zen teachers. So this is the story of one of those encounters. So he went to this holy mountain, which was dedicated to Manjushri, and he encountered what he thought was the priest of a small temple. And they had this little interaction, which is recorded in the book. And he only learned later that this was actually Manjushri, who sometimes takes human form in order to help people out. So Manjushri asked Muchaku, where have you recently come from? So this is the beginning. So what is this? Is it small talk? It may just be small talk. So where are you coming from? Then again, maybe this is Manjushri thinking, let's engage him and see if there's something I can teach him. Let's see if he has delusions or not. Or maybe he's testing him. Let's see what he's got. So Muchaku, he's on the spot here, and he says, from the south. This is a significant answer, from the south. Because this answer could be seen as indicating that he's trapped in the world of distinctions, north versus south. In this case, it's the distinction between the northern and southern schools of Buddhism in China. And northern Buddhism emphasized gradual realization. Southern Buddhism emphasized sudden realization. There are a lot of other differences. But basically, he's saying, I come from the south. Manjushri then asks him, how is southern Buddhism faring? I think Manjushri is giving him another chance here. Is he going to answer with another distinction? Is he going to show he's caught in that world of distinctions? Will he say good or bad? He says, the monks of the latter days of the law observe the Buddha's precepts a little. The monks of the latter days of the law observe the Buddha's precepts a little. So this is about, I read this in Sakita, the first 500 years after the death of Buddha is the age of genuine law. Then there's 1,000 years of pseudo-genuine law, and the following 10,000 years are the latter days of the law. That's kind of a decline. That's kind of what we're in now, which is kind of depressing. But It's not that bad. At least we're showing up at Zen Center on Sunday morning, right? We're still lighting the candle and bumbling along. So, I think this answer, I don't think it's really getting us anywhere. Manjushri asks another question, a very direct question. Manjushri asks, are there many or few? Now Manjushri, I think, is getting to the heart of it. So is Muchaku going to take the bait? And is he going to reply with a number and show that he's lost in the world of distinctions? Or is he going to see that this is a trick question and give an answer showing he's not lost in that world? Is he going to speak from the viewpoint of samadhi, a kind of a non-relative place? So I'm on the edge of my cushion here. What's going to happen? Muchaku answers, here about 300, there around 500. He answers in terms of numbers, quantification. Quantification is a particular kind of distinction that we make. We make many kinds of distinctions. We describe the qualities of things. We judge things as good or bad. We name things. We count things. All of those are possibilities. This koan, I think, is about counting. It's about mathematics, and that's why I was drawn to it. And the more I read koans, the less I can find a single interpretation to stick to because they're so open. They're so open. And I can think of four possible ways to view this answer of here about 300, there around 500. And I'll just tell you very briefly what they are. The first is, yes, he is trapped in the world of distinctions. He's just counting. My heart sinks. This is too bad. Second, he's not trapped in the world of distinctions. He's just playing along. He's giving Manjushri a chance to explain the Dharma. He's being generous. He's kind of willingly playing the fool. This is nice. He's being generous. I admire this. Third, you could say this answer is a little equivocal. True, he answers in terms of numbers, but he says here about 300, there about 500. It's kind of vague. It's kind of fuzzy. We don't really know what the total is. So this is a type of inexactitude about numbers that may anticipate Manjushri's threes and threes comment, which we'll get to in a little bit. And fourth, Muchaku is saying, yeah, I know samadhi. I'm coming from a place of samadhi. And you know what? Even when you're in samadhi, there are still monks. There are still actual monks, and you can still count them. And that can be helpful. For instance, when you're buying groceries, like, hello, Manjushri, there are real monks. And this is a good answer, I think. Anyway, Muchaku comes back at Manjushri. Sakita says he now takes the offensive, true to his reputation. So Muchaku asks Manjushri, how does Buddhism fare in your part of the world? And Sakita says, this could be about how things are on Mount Godai, where this takes place, your part of the world, how are things here? Or it could be about how are things if you are at Manjushri, how are things faring? Manjushri said, the worldly and holy are living together. Dragons and snakes are mingled. All right, here we have it. In a sense, this is the true state of the world. There are no distinctions. Good and bad monks are living together. And in fact, in each good monk, there is a bad monk. And in each bad monk, there is a good monk. In every teacher, there's a student. In every student, there's a teacher. These distinctions make no sense. Everything is mingled. Beautiful answer. What does Muchaku ask now? Are there many or few? Okay. Maybe Muchaku is aware of what's going on and just giving Manjushri a chance to do some further teaching. But you have to wonder here if Muchaku isn't just really missing it. He's like hung up on the numbers. He's relentless. He's like, give me a number, man. None of this snakes and dragons living together stuff. I want to count something. I want quantification. I want something I can hang on to. I want an explanation for the world. I want. When I walk out of the Zendo and see the lake, I want to be satisfied that the lake has some kind of name and it makes some kind of sense and I can find it on a map. The world of immediacy is too scary for me. Well, this wanting, I think, is suffering. And I think we get tired of carrying it around. And I think that underlies this whole koan, is this suffering of wanting. A peculiar kind of wanting in this koan. Something our mind likes to do. So finally we come to Manjushri's answer. The former threes and threes, the latter threes and threes. I love this. Worldly and holy are threes and threes. Dragons and snakes are threes and threes. There's your number, O relentless Muchaku. It's not the number you wanted, but it's the number of thusness. I offer it as kindly as I can to shake you up. Because I love you, Muchaku. Because I am you. The former threes and threes, the latter threes and threes. Manjushri is using the language of distinction, the language of quantification. He's using numbers to describe that which is. And yet he's doing it in sort of a nonsensical way. There are dragons and snakes. He refuses to say how many there are, but there are threes of them. And I think this is not very useful to the mind that desires quantification. There are groups of three everywhere, but it's not tethered to anything. There's no ultimate number. We can't add them up. They're just here. It makes no sense. This is a breakdown of the quantification process. Sakita says about this, and I think this is just beautiful. He says, imagine those people, meaning the monks or the dragons and the snakes. Imagine those people passing in endless succession in twos and threes through eons of time. I think that's beautiful. Numbers free-floating in time and space, attached to nothing. Dragons and snakes, untethered. Threes and threes. It may be nonsense, but it makes as much sense as any other convention that we've adopted. Threes and threes. So there's a verse at the end by Secho, which is not on the program, but the first line of it reads like this. The thousand hills, peak upon peak, deep blue. The thousand hills, peak upon peak, deep blue. And I think this is a beautiful image of infinite, untethered beauty. And Sakita says it captures the essence of this case. Because this line, like threes and threes, brings the world of quantification and the world of non-quantification together. In a way, it transcends that distinction. It's letting the lake be the lake. It's peak upon peak, each perfect and different in itself, and yet none different from another. And there's a number here, the thousand hills. It's a little vague. The thousand hills probably doesn't mean exactly 1,000 hills. It's a number, but it's not really tethered either. So it brings the number back in. It says there are no numbers, and yet there are numbers. So in our ordinary minds, we're trapped in quantification. And then we can see that there is no quantification if we look deeply in the way that this koan helps us to do. We can see that there is no quantification. And then, having seen that, we see quantification. But there still are monks. And we see the usefulness of quantification. And we see its emptiness. And we have a new relationship with it. And it's infinitely amusing. And the rest of Secho's verse is just a little admiration and exultation. Who can converse with Manjushri? How I laugh at many or few. How I admire the former threes and threes, the latter threes and threes. So, as I said, I was drawn to this koan because it's about numbers, and my mind is particularly drawn to numbers. I'm not especially happy about this. If my mind were drawn to, say, music or dance, I think I might have more fun. But that's okay. We get the mind that we get. And I don't know how your mind works. Maybe it's not drawn to numbers. But I suspect everybody's mind has its own deep way of trying to impose order on the world. Something kind of relentless, something like kind of a default position of imposing order on the world. And I think that whatever that is, it may hold you back to some extent from seeing the world as it really is. And your ways of doing this, your default position, may be quite different from mine. But I'm going to talk a little bit about my relationship with numbers. And you can perhaps relate this to whatever organizational principles your mind likes to default to. So when I got tested when I was in grade school, my greatest aptitude was for mathematics. It came easily. I really liked it. I liked the precision of it. I would really enjoy adding up a column of numbers and that kind of thing. But thinking about infinity, which has its own mathematical symbol, gave me a sort of scary and thrilled feeling. If infinity is really infinite, does it hold every possible combination that there is? It seems like it must. Is there a universe exactly like this one, except in that universe the bell is square instead of round? And is there another universe exactly like this one where it's triangular? And are there universes for every possible billion, zillion combinations of things that could be? If infinity is really infinite, you know. And if we think of all the sands of the Ganges and multiply them by the number of all the sands of the Ganges, and we keep doing that infinitely, that's just thrilling. And it almost makes me ill. And I think it makes me see the emptiness of numbers. Against infinity, with all these uncountable possible combinations, how can you quantify anything? And I think I began to suspect early on that there's nothing absolute about these numbers and nothing they can be tied to. We can imagine this infinite series of numbers, negative numbers coming from infinity, and zero right here, right where we are, and positive numbers going into infinity. And that seems like a real thing, but that's untethered too. It's a totally made-up construction that we apply to the universe. We can put zero here, or we can put it over there, or we can put it out in the lake, or we can put it in the year 1850. You know, it's completely arbitrary where we put zero. There is no zero. There's just all of this stuff, and it's all the same. So there's no measuring. And I think that seeing the emptiness of thought and quantification and analysis and going to that uncomfortable place where we're kind of reeling with the idea of infinity is an essential part of our opening up to the way of seeing Zen. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples from my personal experience about kind of seeing that emptiness, kind of seeing the emptiness of the thinking and quantifying function. So the first example has to do with dreams. Sometimes I see the relentlessness and emptiness of the thinking function in dreams. It feels a little weird to sort of let you into how my mind works here. You may be just appalled. I don't know. This is what I do. I'm a teacher, so here goes. So I started writing this talk in November, and I was out in Washington State visiting my new grandson, Oscar, and his dad, Dylan. And at that time, Oscar was 30 days old, and he was already so accomplished that he's getting into this Dharma talk. So he didn't know at that time that he was separate from other things. This sounds really familiar to me, and I think, Tim, you may have said the same thing about your grandson, that when they're first born, they don't know they're separate from other things. They just do not have that knowledge. They have no quantification whatsoever. And that's changed, I'm told, because now he's older and he recognizes his mom and his dad and he'll smile at them and he kind of knows there's something out there different from him. But at that time, he didn't see the difference. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about this trip. I was hanging out with my son Dylan, and we always have a lot of fun. We talk, of course, because we don't see each other that often. And we always talk about music quite a lot. We happen to be talking about the Kinks. This is actually going somewhere, so just bear with me. We were talking about the Kinks, and I said, you know, the Kinks are really underappreciated. They are a really fine band. There's that album they did called Arthur or the Decline and Fall of the British Empire. I think it's one of the 10 best albums ever made, and nobody's ever heard it. How many people have heard this album? See? One person. Okay, so we were talking about that kind of thing. And we went out, and we were just kind of having fun, even though he's really busy. I felt he was giving me his full attention. We went to this pet store to get pet food because they have two cats and a dog. And we went into this store, and we just had a lot of fun in there. And the clerk was so funny. This young woman, she was just not like a usual clerk. Like, oh, you should have hollered at me. You know, I didn't know you were here. And she was telling us all about this store that was across the mall, which was this donut store, new kind of donut store. And she said, they have this maple bacon donut, and I really have to try it. She said, they have this Homer Simpson donut. It's as big as a dinner plate, and it's covered in bright pink frosting. And I was really interested in this, and I was kind of paying attention to this, and I was leaning on the counter and kind of idly touching stuff on the counter, and she goes, ooh, you touched the duck feet. I thought it was really funny. Anyway, so that night I had a dream. And when I woke up the next morning, I wrote it down right away. Because if you do that, you can, you know, really remember the dream pretty well sometimes. In my dream, this dream seemed to go on for a long time. And in this dream, I was working out an organizational system for my life. And sometimes I do this. It's kind of like your waking organizational mind is there, and it wants to do stuff. But it's kind of arranging this random stuff in a way that's not very helpful. I don't know, I'm getting these looks like maybe this doesn't happen to other people. I don't know. This is how my brain works. So in my dream, I came up with this organizational system, and it seemed profound, and it seemed right, and it was useful. And there were four organizational principles for my life. And the first one was the Kinks. And the second one was pet food. And the other two, I don't remember. It could have been donuts, very easily. Donuts and duck feet. Donuts and duck feet. So, and then I wrote in my journal, a little dramatically, I think, but I could see my mind holding back a little from fully embracing these organizational principles. And in my dream, I thought I could see that it's also possible to kind of let that world of night be, to let that world of all these random stimuli from the day, to just let those things be unorganized, you know? And there's kind of this understanding that you can let it be, or you can let it, you can keep organizing. And letting it be, that's the joy of Oscar, you know? He's just laying there. He doesn't know. He doesn't know that he's separate from the rest of the world. And that's a lovely thing. And then there's that other world, you know, which we need sometimes, but it causes us suffering if this other world happens to the exclusion of this world and we can't be there and just let it be anymore. So we've got to work on this. We've got to work on that organization. We've got to find ways to let it go. Seeing it is the first part of letting it go. So, yeah. So this kind of relentlessness of the thinking function. And the second way I've seen that with how that works, how it's relentless, how it causes suffering, has to do with my increasing awareness as my practice has deepened. As my practice has deepened over the years, I kind of see the starkness of my mind's urge to quantify in a way I did not early on. And I can see the moment when it wants to kick in and do its mischief. And it's not just me. I've talked to other experienced practitioners about how when, you know, you kind of get down the road of practice, this sort of self, this quantifying self, gets a little stark, it can get a little upset. It's kind of fighting for its life, you know. It knows something's going on here. And it's a little worried. And it's like, and you see it for what it is, which is like this instinct, this sort of driving instinct. And this can be obvious to me when I'm fatigued, because it's really strong. And it's also obvious sometimes when I wake up at night. I might wake up at, say, 2 a.m., and when I do, I'm immediately aware of how that thinking function wants to kick in. And I have a choice right there. I can let it kick in, or I cannot let it kick in. And sometimes I don't. Sometimes I really can't stop it. Sometimes in extreme cases, I'm really wound up. I'll get up and I'll meditate in the middle of the night for a half hour. And then it calms down and I'm okay. But it's kind of lurking there like a wild animal, ready to start. And it doesn't care what the subject matter is. It'll latch on to anything. You know, baseball statistics, finances, donuts, duck feet. It doesn't matter. It'll make something out of it. So when I first began writing this talk, I put that part about it's like a wild animal in there. And that was just kind of a simile that came to me. But then I started thinking about that some more. And I started thinking a little bit about the six realms. I've been working with Bouchot on practice period for spring. We're going to be talking about the six realms, which are these psychological states that we can all fall into. And one of them is the human realm, which we're in now. And in the human realm, we can see all of the realms. It kind of encompasses all the realms, and we can see the animal realm and the hell realm and the fighting titan realm and things like that. And here, from the perspective of being a human, it appears to me that this thinking function is part of the animal realm, which is the opposite of what you might think, because animals don't think, at least not in the way we do. So how can thinking be part of the animal realm? But it occurred to me that thinking is the instinct of the human animal. We are hardwired to think, because that enables us to survive. That is what separates us from... That's what gives us our edge, you know? I can turn this stick into a spear if I use this sharp rock. It's very useful. It has helped us to survive and sort of conquer the earth. But because it's hardwired, we bring it to every situation we're in. And it causes us suffering. The way animal urges cause suffering to the animals in the Buddhist scheme. And you may argue that's not really suffering, but the point is that's our animal urge. This urge to organize reality, it's almost as strong as the urge to, say, pull our finger away from a hot stove, but not quite. Not quite, because we can change that hard wiring. It is possible. There are all kinds of stories we tell ourselves, and all kinds of suffering that we have, and all kinds of perceived limitations that we have that seem to be hardwired and unchangeable, and they can be changed. And I know they can be changed. I speak from experience. The more you can see whatever your sort of naked impulses are, the more you can do something about them. You have a choice. When you wake up, you don't have to let it kick in. You can go back to sleep. And during the day, when you're driving or whatever, and you see that ordering mind want to come in, you have a choice. You can indulge it, and maybe that's useful. Maybe you have something you need to think about. But you can also choose to just let it be. And save that left brain for another time. I have a job where I use my left brain a lot. That's the time to let it run. And that's the thing, to let it run at an appropriate time. But not, you know, not when I'm standing at the altar, you know, lighting the incense. That's not the time to let that organizing function run, you know. Let it go. Let it go. There's right thought. You know, you can have right thought and take joy in it. But not all the time. So that's about it. I'd just like to finish by undermining everything I've said. Because haven't I set up a dichotomy here? By saying it, on the one hand, we have the quantifying mind, and on the other hand, we have this sort of pleasant mind, the mind that sees the interdependent universe for what it is. So we have these two things, this good thing and this bad thing. So I have. How can that be? How can it be that I set up a dichotomy? I'm trying to explain there are no distinctions, so I made this distinction. You know, how can there be two things? And what can we say about that? Threes and threes. Threes and threes. We can say that. But even that might be wearing a little thin. And we can turn that into a thing. Threes and threes. And it shouldn't be a thing. So we have to do something different. Like, it's this, you know? And it's also this. And it's also Stacy. And it's also Laura. And it's also not Laura, because that was so 2 seconds ago. So it's just what it is. It's just this, you know, and let's all just hang out in this for a while. I invite you to just stay here with this. Just stay here with this. And you don't need all of those numbers. Except when you do. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, that was fun. All right. Do we have a comment or anything? Yes, Stacy.
It occurs to me that Oscar is protected and provided for, and I think somewhat therefore able to experience this non-distinction without having to do the math or figure out what has to happen.
Yes.
So I wonder where in the practice do you find that protection and provision offered so we can be absorbed into the wholeness?
Well, I think right thought covers that. Right thought is a part of practice. And it's an absolutely essential part of our practice that we take care of ourselves and we keep ourselves safe and we use this thinking function when we need to, you know. And I think the practicality of our practice here at the center helps us with all of that. And I'm spending a lot of time dissing thought today because I think thought is where we tend to get hung up. But I don't want to diss it so much as to say, you know, thought's really bad and let's all kind of just float around like Oscar. Because we really can't. You know, we really have to pay attention and we really have to be careful. So that is an essential part of our practice. And I only emphasize the sort of non-thought part because I think that's what most of us need. But, you know, it's really, they're both absolutely the deal, and they're the same deal.
But how do we know that we're safe to go into that?
To go into that?
What you're implying is like a more abstract mind.
I think that's a decision we each have to make based on what we know about ourselves. And I'm really glad you mentioned that because it's really important that we do that deliberately. You know, that we kind of approach these things deliberately and think, what are we ready for here? You know, letting go. To what extent are we comfortable with that? And we all need this sort of healthy ego and way to approach the world that's going to keep us safe, you know? When do we need to enhance that and work on that? When do we need to kind of let that go? And I think it's good to do that deliberately. It may be very good to have a teacher help you with that, someone to talk through with that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes?
I have a question about the comments, and I wanted to make sure I actually what you said about animals and the way that you kind of differentiate yourself from other animals. Because I understood it that they're not, that they won't think. And I guess I was a little confused with that, and I know that I tend to differentiate myself between other animals in the fact that we have language,
mm-hmm.
and that we have a structure to our language, and that it's rule-defined, but then even some argument about some other animals having language, we're sort of finding that out. But
mm-hmm.
I know what you're saying, like there's sort of a metacognition where we're aware of how we think, but I think there's some debate on some animals really being able to think at that level. So I guess I just wanted to hear your... I feel like that was a big mistake.
Yeah, thank you. When I first wrote this, I said, animals don't think. And I went through it again. I thought, well, I don't know. I think they do, you know. Some animals know how to use tools, and dolphins seem incredibly intelligent, and elephants clearly mourn the dead. And there's a lot of stuff going on there. But I'm kind of using, there's kind of this idea, and I need to look into this more. I really need to review sort of the Buddhist view of what the animal realm is like. But I think there's kind of this idea that animals have these base desires and it's a source of suffering. But that's maybe a useful thing to say, but it's very general, you know. And we don't want to be too absolute here. I mean, we're in the animals are in us. To some extent, they do have the thinking function. So I'm not trying to say that there's some kind of hierarchy or some superiority here on the part of humans.
Okay. I was just trying to...
Yeah, thank you for the question. Maybe one more question. Yes, Eric?
Yeah, this is just a slight comment on that. I think the main difference is that animals don't really appear to kind of tell themselves stories about themselves to the extent that people do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of why a lot of people will distinguish suffering versus pain, that pain is pain and suffering is telling yourself the story about the pain. And maybe some animals do tell themselves stories about themselves, but when I, you know, see an animal really appears to be genuinely what it is. When you think of a tiger, tigers don't seem uncomfortable in being tigers, and hippos don't seem uncomfortable in being hippos, but I think a lot of people are really uncomfortable being people, and that seems to be that kind of comes from our excessive levels of abstraction, which has, you know, ups and downs.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you everyone for your kind attention this morning.